This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
I think it really is about allowing our hearts to be open, and when necessary, to break for someone else, and then asking for the Holy Spirit to push us in whatever direction that we are supposed to go as individuals. It won't be the same for everyone. But when we have a new heart, a tender heart, and when we're sensitive to the pain of others, then almost always we'll find some way to act.
You are listening to Quick to Listen. I'm Morgan Lee. I'm a co-host here at the show and an assistant editor for Christianity Today magazine. And I am joined today by Caitlin Beatty, but also as always, hi, Caitlin.
Hey, Morgan. How's it going?
It's great to have you here. And
thanks.
I'm looking forward to telling us all who our guest is this week, who I think is going to be a real treat.
Yeah. So this week we are joined by a person leader that many of our readers and listeners have probably encountered over the last few years. Joshua Dubois is founder and director of Values Partnerships, a consulting firm that fosters faith-based partnerships in the public, private, and neighborhood nonprofit sectors. He formerly led the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships and was named President Obama's Pastor-in-Chief by Time magazine. He was also named one of Christianity Today's 33 Under 33 Leaders to Watch back in 2014. He wrote a book, The President's Devotional, and lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, Michelle, and his son, August. Thanks so much for joining us, Joshua.
Caitlin, Morgan, it's wonderful to be on with you. Thanks for having me on Quick to Listen.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.
Joshua, is it true that you just like went to work at the White House for a couple of years? Like that was your office?
Yeah. It was wild. You kind of had to pinch yourself walking around there some days and just give glory to God for the opportunity. But yeah, no, I started working for then Senator Obama long before he was president. And then when he was elected, transitioned into the White House. Yeah.
And this is kind of a fangirl question, but how exactly did you connect initially with Senator, now President, Obama?
Yeah, it was the summer of 2004, and I was doing an internship on Capitol Hill and was in a restaurant eating a hamburger, actually. And I,
wow.
I looked up at the television screen and I saw this guy with this really odd name, Barack Obama, giving this amazing speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston in 04. And he, you know, was talking about policy issues that I cared about. And he was talking about, you know, the poor and marginalized. And then out of nowhere, he said, and we worship an awesome God, even in the blue states. And, you know, as both a progressive and a strong believer, I said, you know what, this guy is right. We do. And, you know, just kind of rocketed me back to singing Our God is an Awesome God at FCA camps and so forth of my childhood. And just kind of one of those moments where I felt like I was nudged to reach out to him. And so wrote him a few form letters, got some form letter responses, and to make a very long story short, and I'm happy to share more, just basically showed up at his office a couple of times until they gave me an interview. And so that's a short version of a pretty long story.
It's like a parable, like the parable of the persistent door knocker or something.
Or the annoying early millennial at that point trying to find
yes,
his place in the world.
Yes, the parable of the eager and hungry millennial who is willing to knock on the president's door. Well, we're really grateful to have you on our show today.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
So let me get into the discussion that we will be having and give everyone an overview of that. As many listeners know, last week, the deaths of the Twin Cities, Philando Castile, and Baton Rouge's Anton Sterling were both captured on videotape. And in this instance, these were two Black men who were shot by police officers, bringing to mind the deaths of, among others, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, and Eric Garner, whose deaths were also captured on camera. And these deaths sparked Black Lives Matter protests around the country, including Dallas, which had its own march last Thursday night. And after the protest concluded there, a sniper shot and killed five police officers who had been patrolling the event. So in the wake of these deaths, we've seen more Black Lives Matter protests, we've seen kind of like the rise of Police Chief David Brown, whose remarks many have found healing and refreshing, and a memorial service, which I'll touch on a little bit later, where Brown, but also President Bush and President Obama spoke yesterday. We've also seen calls from Christians of color exhorting white Christians and those from majority culture to speak more truthfully and emphatically on systemic racism. We also know that from experience, those in majority culture can at times drown out the voices of others, and sometimes they can fail to listen, and they can attempt to draw conclusions about things or make remarks before they have a grasp of the situation. So today I really want to talk about listening and the tension of listening and figuring out when to speak. And I want to just read something that I thought was kind of applicable that President Obama remarked yesterday in his address at the Dallas Memorial Service. And he said, quote, "I've seen how inadequate words can be in bringing about lasting change. I've seen how inadequate my own words have been." And so I'm reminded of a passage in John's Gospel: "Let us love not with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." Before I get into it and ask everyone to give us a gut check or their initial reactions from this Dallas Memorial Service and President Obama's remarks, I just wanted to take a moment to talk about a way that you can get your hands on a copy of our magazine, Christianity Today Magazine. A subscription to that is what makes this podcast possible. Christianity Today Magazine offers redemptive and honest coverage of people, events, and ideas that shape church and culture. And so as a subscriber, each year you're going to get our 10 award-winning print issues. You will be able to read our magazine on your tablet or via PDF form. You get complete web access to ChristianityToday.com, and that includes visiting our archives back to 1956. And so for those of you that listen to Quick to Listen, we invite you to subscribe for $10 a year. And you can do that at orderct.com/quicktolisten. So orderct.com/quicktolisten. So without further ado, let's head back to the gut check. Joshua, I'm just wondering if you can kick us off for what was your initial gut check, maybe in 140 characters or less, of the Dallas Memorial Service and President Obama's remarks?
Yeah. First, I thought it was a call for tender hearts. It was a call from the president for us to reject the cynicism and numbness that comes after seeing all of this violence and division. He asked us for our hearts to break, and then once broken, to try to do something, whatever we can in our power to do. So when he quoted 1 John, he was saying, guys and ladies, American people, I can't do this on my own. I need your help. And I don't even know if my words are enough. So I need your help in this process of American renewal. And that he was calling for an empathy revolution. He was calling for people to join him in this process of American renewal.
Yeah, it's a really interesting passage that President Obama quoted. And it sounds like it's from 1 John, not John's Gospel. We know that our listeners are Bible nerds, so they will very quickly pick up on the difference between the two. But it's an interesting passage. I wonder if words and actions are really that different, because when we speak, we are enacting something. I would say uttering words have incredible power in the world to shape our life together. And so actually speaking on the tragedies of last week, speaking things of lament, of solidarity, of needing change, these are actions, and they're powerful actions. And oftentimes words are the most powerful thing we have.
My own gut reaction to the memorial service in general was that it felt overall healing. I think there was something that was really strong to me about the symbolism of having the former President Bush there, George W. Bush, and having President Obama both deliver remarks and then grab each other's hand at the end of the service. And reminds me too, when you're talking about words, another thing that's powerful to me is also symbols. And I found that particularly moving at the same time, knowing that they represent different parts of our country and different backgrounds, and in many ways two different really divisive eras for their own particular reasons.
We're in such a polarized moment in our country, and that's part of what makes mourning tragedies like last week's even more difficult. And so that I resonate with that, the power of that symbolism as well.
Yeah, the only other thing that I would add, if I may, is that I thought the president sort of subtly redrew the lines of civic discourse in a way. It was really interesting to me that he placed the police officers in Dallas and the protesters sort of on the same side. You know, he was saying the protesters are helping to renew our democracy by critiquing things that they see that are wrong. The police officers are helping to protect our democracy. So it's folks who are working to perfect our union on one side and folks who are working to tear our union down on another side, whether that's through violence, through division, hate, and manifested in various forms. And so it's just a sort of an interesting way to think about things, that the black-white divide is important and must be analyzed, but it's also, you know, are you contributing to the solution, or are you contributing to the problem? It seems to be sort of an overarching theme of the president's remarks.
Joshua, I wanted to ask you about something that you personally did last week, which is you went on Twitter and you created a form letter that people, whom in this case you framed to as non-black friends, could send to their police department. Can you tell me a little bit about your thought process in creating that and putting that online?
Yeah, it started as just a sort of a very personal thing. So I live outside of D.C., and I realize I have never had a conversation with my police chief in my town. And I have a 10-month-old son, an African-American son, a little boy who will eventually be a young man. And I wanted to have that dialogue to both affirm the hard and difficult work that police officers engage in every day, but also to ask questions about how prepared they are to de-escalate conflict, to reveal and address any bias. And by the way, when I say bias, every single one of us has some level of bias. It's a scientific fact. And so that's not a pejorative thing I'm saying about the officers. I'm saying that we all have some level of implicit sort of subconscious bias, and are they trained to deal with that? So I realized I'd never asked these questions before. And if I'm going to advocate for change at the federal level, systemic level, if I'm going to tweet, if I'm going to address these issues with my words, then I should also take a practical step in my own community. And it's sort of a shame that I hadn't done that up until that point. And so I wrote my police chief, and I shared the text of it in case other people wanted to do the same. And it was amazing how it just sort of took off. It was sort of retweeted around 5,000 times, like 700,000 people have seen it. And what's fascinating is that people are writing their own chiefs, and the chiefs are responding. I just got a note about an hour ago, I think, you know, with another response from the police chief. Sam Veach said his local police department responded with answers to the questions about anti-bias training, de-escalating conflict. Police department in Orlando, actually the chief responded on Twitter answering some of these questions. And then the letter concluded by saying that as you do these things, we're here to support you. You know, you're not just out here on your own. When you take these steps, we want you to know that we're here to support you. And so it's just been, amazing seeing how, you know, just a simple practical step is, you know, kind of helps people see a little bit through the fog and gives them something that they can do that can actually help the community.
Yeah. What I really like about the form letter that you made available, Joshua, is how it focuses action on local communities. So I think we often, as Christians, we think that our calling is to change, quote unquote, the culture, like this big, massive, ephemeral thing out there, when in fact, the culture is whatever local community and context we find ourselves in. So when we talk about changing policing and holding our police departments to accountability, we have to start with our very own police department. And it's amazing how so few of us actually think to start there. Like we're more prone to like tweet something or post something on social media about the police, when in fact, as citizens in a democracy, we actually have some agency in holding our own local police departments accountable. So I really appreciate how localized your solution, the solution that you offered, is.
Yeah. And you know, just and thank you for that. And just very practically, oftentimes challenges come not with departments that engage with African Americans on a regular basis, because those departments are almost by definition, they have to be more trained on some of these issues, but really in communities that are somewhat more homogenous, that, you know, someone may be driving through who the police have not dealt with on a regular basis. And so, you know, suburban communities that may be predominantly Caucasian, these are some of the places where we need to be having this conversation with the police the most. I think as believers, we often get stuck on, you know, the level of addressing the powers and principalities of this world, but without getting down to the to the granular work of addressing the challenges that are right in front of us. And we have to remember that, you know, our Savior was a very personal Savior who engaged with people and issues face to face every single day, and that he walked this earth. And if we're going to model ourselves after him, we've got to be willing to get our hands dirty as well, not at the macro level, but really at the micro level in our communities.
This episode is brought to you by Preaching Today. Are you tired of chasing down quality sermon illustrations? Need fresh ideas for helping your message connect? Each week, Preaching Today adds fresh content to our database of over 14,000 editor-screened illustrations. Quickly find the right story that will bring your message to life and help your people move closer to God. Get started today at preachingtoday.com.
So Joshua, in this case, you were creating a situation where people in majority culture could use their voice, with obviously a big help from you, to speak directly into some issues that may be affecting their local community. I'm wondering, in circumstances like these, what voices really should be elevated during this time, and how should they be elevated?
Well, I wouldn't want to be overly prescriptive. I would say that, you know, people, as they consult their own hearts and the Spirit of God, and they should respond accordingly. I think there's a spectrum, you know, the voices of experts, people who have engaged on these difficult, complex matters for a long time, should certainly be out there. You know, the Ta-Nehisi Coateses of the world, Michael Eric Dysons, and also the people who have engaged these issues from the perspective of the church. But I also think there's space for everyday folks, including people of color, to just mourn, to express anger, to express frustration. And there's a lot of space for solidarity from people who are not in these communities but want to express support. And I may be in the, sometimes I don't know that, you know, people always agree with me on this one, but I personally think that there's a space for silence as well. I'm not one of those who think that, you know, if you're not posting something on Facebook, that necessarily means that you're like opposed to me, or you're apathetic, or you don't care. I think sometimes people are just sort of overwhelmed and processing and don't know what to say. And so part of what I was trying to do with, you know, with this tweet and with this step was, okay, here's something you can do that is contributing to a solution that doesn't force you to be sort of an eloquent summarizer of our race problem in your Twitter. Like, not everyone's able to do that, right? But we all can do something. And so that's what sort of this was all about.
So one of the common lines of thought that I've heard after tragedies like this that uniquely affect communities of color is, basically, for those, you know, majority culture people who feel like they want to do something or want to be part of the solution, they will often turn to persons of color and say, what should I do? What can I do? And the response to that is like, stop asking me what you can do. Like, either figure it out yourself, or maybe you're not actually part of the solution, or maybe you don't get to like drive the change in this situation. It sounds like you're not, you're of a different belief in this regard and a different philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between driving the change and just sort of being, you know, a helpful contributor to the change. In my premarital counseling with my wife, one of the key things that our counselor would say to us, and I think this is a pretty consistent thing across marriage counselors, is that you're not allowed to force the other person to automatically know what to do and what to think. Like, you actually have to articulate, even if you don't want to, even if you want them, if you wish that they just knew the next step, the right step, that's an unfair expectation. And I think that's the case with some of these issues as well. Yes, in an ideal world, I would need no translator for my anger, for my pain. People would automatically know how to address these issues. But the reality is, we're human, we're frail, and people don't always know. And so I think if you have it in you to give people some guidance and some help and some perspective, and if they choose to then take that up and take a small step, I think that's perfectly fine. I think it's okay for people of color, not of color, to want to be a part of the solution, to ask how to engage, but then, you know, just be sincere in it, you know, actually, then actually follow up and do it, or pose something else. I guess the last thing is, part of what is underlying the response from people of color sometimes is, don't always just talk to me about it, talk with your own circles, right? And so I am one who thinks that we need to have more conversations about race at predominantly white churches than predominantly black churches. Like, I would love for every white evangelical congregation in this country to host a Black History Month event next year, just to, like, you know, become wise on these issues, to engage this history in our country. So part of what you're hearing from people of color is we don't always want to brief people on things that they really should know if they care about this country, because this is an important part of our national story. It's a little bit of do your research and then let's talk.
There are circles that you're a part of. There are family members that you have access to. There are places that you can go and have deeper, more intense conversations, and maybe some of what you need to do, that work needs to start there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, which I think goes into a little bit of what I was just wanted to bring up about this, like, term conversation, right? And how that can kind of be applied to both social media or to workplace conversations or to small group conversations or the one-on-one that you have with your pastor. And that the rules of engagement for those conversations, whether it's listening or speaking, may apply completely differently depending on, like, the level of relationship and how public those conversations are with people and what your silence can communicate, whether it's in person or through a place that's, you know, completely mediated through, like, digital means. You talked about the word solidarity, and I didn't know if you could give any examples of where you've seen solidarity be at its most powerful or most effective.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole range. You know, from my friend Doug Birdsall, you know, the former head of the Lausanne movement, and for a time the American Bible Society, who started a whole initiative and movement to help engage white evangelical pastors on issues of race, you know, something significant and long lasting like that. To my friend Jessica, you know, my wife and I's good friend, who texted me and says, you know, in the middle of last week, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. I don't even know what to post, but I just want you to know I'm thinking about you and praying for the right way to respond to these issues. And so, and everything in between. So I think it really is about this notion, and it's really, and the president said it yesterday, of, you know, of a tender heart, allowing our hearts to be open and, when necessary, to break for someone else, and then asking for the Holy Spirit to push us in whatever direction that we are supposed to go as individuals. It won't be the same for everyone, but when we have a new heart, a tender heart, and when we're sensitive to the pain of others, then almost always we'll find some way to act.
I was struck last week by how many white evangelical leaders were quickly and directly speaking out against these shootings of African-American men and connecting it to a larger problem of systemic injustice in our country. And then I was also struck by my own reticence to say something, not because my heart wasn't breaking, but because I thought, what could I possibly contribute to the conversation that is necessary in this moment? That prayer and, you know, reaching out to friends of color wouldn't that be more powerful than just going on Twitter and voicing my opinions? I think my concern is that when majority culture leaders speak out on these issues, it becomes about them and their thoughts and opinions rather than about communities who are more directly affected by tragedies like last week's.
I think that's an appropriate concern. And that's why I think just the response has got to be so personalized. You know, in this case, you may have been led to a more private and reflective response, but in other cases, you are going to feel and have felt like you have something to add to the conversation. And that's why, you know, I think that they are all appropriate if they come from a good place, a courageous place, an authentic place. And so that's, you know, I think there can be a range of responses.
There's going to be a variety of responses from the people who are most directly affected by the issue. And that when, as we're looking through how they're processing and making sense of things and the ways that they're reacting to how majority culture is or is not involved on this, there's not a standard person of color response to how this this gets out there. And you can't just ask that one person of color who you're cool with on Twitter to approve how you're going to be feeling, or in that instance, and especially then generalize that everyone else that might be the same religion or race as them will then somehow also find your words powerful or soothing or comforting. And it's just important to not see that group as monolithic in that way.
The other piece that's important in times like this, candidly, is like a little bit of resilience, because sometimes, particularly when people are angry and particularly after tragedies like this, you may speak out and, you know, people may find some small issue with what you said and respond out of that anger or out of that frustration. My message to the majority community would be, you know, keep coming from a place of love. Don't disengage. Have a level of sort of emotional resilience, and don't allow the very real and authentic frustration and anger that's felt within communities of color. Don't allow that to push you away from showing your heart. I think sometimes people get a little intimidated because these are tough, thorny, really difficult issues. And even when they have something to contribute, they don't feel like they can without sort of getting beat up, right? And the reality is, from time to time, you may be some pushback, but I would rather have people authentically asking real questions and engaging than, you know, operating in silence or completely disengaged and disinterested. So
yeah, I mean, going back to the, you know, the premarital counseling and the marriage metaphor, if one spouse is really upset and angry and grieving after a tragedy or after something has happened to them, you hope that the other spouse has the capacity to say, I can receive your anger. I don't fully understand it. Uh-huh. I don't have the same emotional response, but I see that you are angry and that's okay. A loving spouse won't try to determine what emotions are okay or not okay after something painful has happened. In good faith, I think a lot of majority culture Christians want to have that posture, but it also feels personal, or it feels like, I don't know what to do for you. And maybe there's a level of impatience, you know, but I think that marriage metaphor is actually really powerful, Joshua.
Yeah, you know, we're still trying to live and walk it out, but, you know, I've learned a lot along along the way, mostly from Michelle Dubois rather than things that I...
Should we have Michelle on to talk about marriage and...
Let me stop and hand her the...
Right.
But yeah, that said, let me just note that there are some like basic triggers, and I actually hate that word, but there are some basic things that, like, if possible, you know, don't fall into some of these traps, like, you know, one, responding to incidents of violence against African Americans with, what about black on black crime? Like, just Google that first, and there are some really great answers for why those are, you know, kind of distinct issues. Along the same lines, like, even if you are more on the All Lives Matter side than the Black Lives Matter side, at least know what people are saying, what they mean when they're saying Black Lives Matter. The short version is they mean Black Lives Matter too, because for far too long it has felt like Black lives did not matter as much. So, I mean, they're just sort of some basic things that when you tweet those, when you Facebook those without doing a little research around, you know, where people are coming from, then that will, in fact, trigger, I think, unhelpful responses, because it's probably an unhelpful assertion in the first place.
Well, thank you so much for providing those resources for our listeners, Joshua. I just want to let everyone know that they can continue this conversation, and I'm sure start other conversations of their own on Facebook and Twitter. But specifically for us, you can find us at CT Podcast, which is on Twitter at CT Podcast, or facebook.com/CT Podcasts. So we are going to shift gears right now for the segment of the show that we call Precious Moments. A time of the show that we intentionally devote to recognizing things that bring us joy. So I've asked Joshua and Caitlin to tell us a movie or TV show that is bringing them joy this week, and also to share where we can all find them online. So Joshua, go ahead.
Sure. So I'm online at Joshua Dubois on Twitter. I am not cool enough for Snapchat yet. And my Instagram is all pictures of me smoking meat and barbecue. Be clear, meat, pork shoulders and so forth. Not smoking anything else.
Smoking meat.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, the pork shoulders, ribs, etc. So if you're interested in that, feel free to follow me on Instagram and also an endless stream of pictures of my 10-month-old, but mostly Twitter at Joshua Dubois. And what is giving me joy media-wise these days? I mean, it's really boring. I'm sorry. I watch at least an episode of Modern Family on DVR, before bed almost every night. And
you have our comfort media.
Oh, man, I can't. It used to, first it was Seinfeld, then it was The Office for years, and now it's Modern Family. And so that helps me calm down at the end of a long day. So,
and I will just commend Joshua's Instagram feed, even though it features a lot of meat and I'm not like super passionate about meat. His son, August, is so cute, and I can't get enough of cute baby photos. So.
He's teething right now. So if there are any would-be babysitters out in CT podcast land, let me know.
Caitlin, do you watch TV?
I'm kind of in a slump right now. I will go through seasons where I get really excited about a show and watch it through like a couple times. I'm someone who watches TV shows like multiple times through. But right now I'm actually in a slump. So I'm just going to mention the new Ghostbusters movie featuring the all-female cast. This is from Paul Feig, who did Freaks and Geeks and several other strong woman movies in the past 10 years. And there's been a lot of chatter about having an all-female cast in the original Ghostbusters story, but I'm excited about seeing it. I am a fan of all of the comedians who are featured in the movie. And you can learn more about me at Caitlin Beatty on Twitter. And I actually just set up a website to let people know about my new book, which I will be talking to our colleague Richard Clark about soon on an episode of The Calling, which is our brother podcast. But you can find me there at CaitlinBeatty.com.
So one film that is bringing me joy is a oral history production that was put together by some youth in my neighborhood in Chicago. And I had the chance to screen it last night at the Chicago History Museum. It's a neighborhood that Martin Luther King Jr. actually lived close by. He lived right below that. And he preached and organized in a church that's a couple minutes away walking from my house. But essentially after his death, a lot of the activism and the work that he had done and the legacy of that had not been really preserved well. And so there were quite a few youth that belonged to this film team that's part of a nonprofit in my neighborhood. And they went out and they did about 25 different community interviews. And then they put it together in a film that I got to watch last night.
That's cool.
And you can find me on Twitter at MEPAYNL. Anyway, guys, that is it for this week. We are super thankful for you guys listening and checking out another episode of Quick to Listen. And this show is produced by Richard Clark and Cray Allred. Thank you always to Kate Shelnut. Please subscribe to our show via iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Overcast, whatever you'd like. And if you like the show, beyond tweeting that you like the show and letting us know, you can do that through rating and reviewing us on iTunes. And that helps a lot. We will see you all next week.
See ya.